My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me now and we will explore these topics and so much more with fascinating guests, authors, and experts who'll guide us to Destination Unlimited. We live in a world where, for the most part, we are welcomed into life with a joyous and loving anticipation. Many of us have been born in hospitals, and some have been welcomed at home with our arrival facilitated by a midwife or doula. As joyful and warm as our arrivals may be, how often it seems that our departure from this life is cold, sterile, sad, and incomplete for those we leave behind. What if there was a doula to support us and our families when we pass in a life-affirming way that liberates the spirit and brings maximum comfort to our loved ones? Such doulas do exist, and my guest this evening on Destination Unlimited, Henry Fersko Weiss, created the first end-of-life doula program in the United States in 2003. Henry is executive director of the International End of Life Doula Association and has built many programs based upon his original model. His work has been featured in the New York Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, as well as others. He's on the faculty of the Open Center's Art of Dying Institute, and he joins us this evening to discuss his new book, Caring for the Dying, The Doula Approach to a Meaningful Death. Please welcome Henry Fersko Weiss. Good evening, Henry.
Good evening. Thank you.
And thank you so much for joining us. So as a pioneer in your field, what led you to create the very first end-of-life doula program in the country? And why do you think doulas are so important at the end of life?
So I was a hospice social worker, field social worker, working in a large hospice in New York City. And I kept encountering deaths that I thought shouldn't have occurred the way they did. Even though the person had hospice, they would wind up going to the hospital when they had really wanted to die at home. The loved ones may have missed the last breaths. There was a lot of anxiety and fear and a sense of being ill-prepared that family often experienced in spite of having hospice to help them as they approached those last days. So as I kept seeing these, what I thought of as unfortunate ways that people were dying, I kept trying to figure out how, as a social worker, I could make it different, at least in my hospice. And at about the same time, a friend of mine decided to become a birth doula. And when she told me this, I had never heard the term doula before. So I was very intrigued, and she told me about the training she took and then how she was helping women in labor. And as I listened more and more to what she was doing, I realized that this was exactly what we should be doing at the end of life. That with that approach, those tools, the techniques, the spirit that birth doulas brought to helping women in labor and their partners would make perfect sense at the end of life to help a dying person and their family through this experience.
Now, having experienced personally a hospice situation many years ago, prior to the work that you're doing and have done, hospice traditionally was about keeping the patient or the person comfortable, attending to their medical needs, pain relief and such, but there was no emphasis placed upon the spiritual needs or the emotional needs. Did you find that with most hospice situations? Is that one of the motivating factors behind your work?
Yes, it is. You know, I did see in a lot of instances that the focus seems to be on the medical. The most hospices in our country now are based on a medical model, and it's really the medical piece of it that they emphasize and that they pay the most attention to. And the spiritual and the emotional pieces, although the social workers and chaplains that are connected to hospice, work for hospice, try to attend to those issues, they don't have the time to spend with people so that they're making a concerted effort on working on those issues. If they come in for a half hour, an hour visit once a week, once every couple of weeks, that's about all they can manage with the caseloads they have to carry. And so you can't do the kind of work around exploring a person's life meaning, helping them think through how they have learned things in their life, the values they've tried to maintain, the spiritual issues that they may have tried to address in their lives, and what they want to leave behind in the hearts and minds of their loved ones. Those things often go unaddressed, and that has become a main focus of the work we do.
Just to share my personal, I've had two personal experiences that I'd like to share with you just to bring some of this information to our listeners. The first situation, I'm an ordained interfaith minister. I had attended the New Seminary of New York back in the mid to late 90s. And prior to that, I had been asked by my cousin to help her plan for my aunt's funeral, my aunt who was in the process of transitioning. And my aunt had been in a coma, and the indication was she would not be around for much longer. And naturally, now this is, I'm talking 19, probably 91, I went up and I was really there to support my cousin, who was in bad straits in terms of her emotional and also the logistics and practicality of preparing for a funeral. And in the process of doing so, I sort of intuitively said to each of the members of the family who were present that it might be a good idea. My cousin was exhausted. I wanted to get her out of the room and get her something to eat. And I said to my other cousins and those who were there that it might not be a bad idea for them one at a time to just spend a few minutes telling my aunt, and in that case it would have been their grandmother or cousin, how they felt about her and how much they loved her and anything that they didn't have an opportunity to say to her at that time. And they all did. And when we came back, I told my cousin to do the same, suggested that she do the same. And after that, I had a sense that my aunt was ready to go. And we stood around the bed, and we held hands, and I said to everybody, just beam love, and no tears, no pain. Beam love. Go on your way. We love you. It's time for you to go. And within a few minutes, she actually transitioned, and that was naturally probably one of the most beautiful things I'd ever experienced in a situation like that. A little more painful personal situation, my former partner, Judy, had breast cancer, which had gone to the brain. And she and I actually had attended that seminary together. And shortly after our graduation from the seminary in November of 1997, she basically went into final decline, went to the hospital. I wanted to take her on home hospice, and they allowed me to do so, and we brought her home. And again, the emphasis had been on how to change her IVs, how to administer the morphine if she was in pain, how to keep the oxygen going, how to change all of the practical aspects. Fortunately, I had that background, trained as an interfaith minister, and I had the spiritual background. But I could picture someone who was not given those abilities and trainings really having a hard, hard time doing this. And my partner's passing was beautiful and peaceful, and I was very, very appreciative and grateful to have been there to help facilitate it. But I said to myself, and this is, again, this would have been January of 98, I said, someone needs to develop something like this. So thank you for what you did, because I believe there's such a calling for this in this world today.
Yeah, I agree, absolutely. You know, it's so unfortunate that people end up dying in fear and anxiety, or in, you know, great pain and suffering, and the family feels ill-prepared, doesn't know what to do, they're exhausted emotionally and physically by the time they get to the last days of life. And they can't really be present and be there for their loved one in a way that they, I know, would like to be, and that would make it such a more meaningful experience. So I really think that this doula approach helps people in so many ways to have a different kind of dying experience. And I'm just glad that that friend of mine talked to me about becoming a birth doula, because it changed my life. It helped me to to see what could happen at the end of life and how much richer that experience could be, even more beautiful than most deaths happen to be.
Absolutely. You know, you've chosen an avocation and a teaching that a lot of people would be afraid of. How do you get people to overcome their fear of their basic fear of death and become doulas?
You know, I find that the people who come to the trainings that I do are often people who already have dealt with that fear to some extent. Sometimes not, or not entirely, but most of the time, people come because they sense this is a calling, and they feel in their heart that this is work they need to do. Either they've experienced a death like you did that was peaceful and beautiful, or they experienced a death that was just not the kind of death they had hoped for, and they want to make it different for other people. So to some extent, there's a kind of a natural selection, I think. People who come to train as end-of-life doulas have already started to deal with that fear of death. But one of the things that we do in our training is we do take a look inside to try and explore our own orientation, thoughts, and feelings in regards to death. We go back and look at some of the experiences we've had and try to pull out of those experiences the pieces that we've learned about what it means to be dying and what it means to no longer be alive. And we explore through visualization and exercises some of our own feelings about being mortal. And I think that helps also for people who do this work.
Absolutely. My guest this evening, Henry Frisco Weiss. He's the author of Caring for the Dying, The Doula Approach to a Meaningful Death. And we'll have more with Henry after these words on the OM Times Radio Network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org, but you're probably not going to, are you? Kids, work, listening to the radio. You're busy, which is great because busy people can't get prediabetes. Oh my, I read that wrong. They can. Should have worn my glasses. So visit doihaveprediabetes.org and take a short test because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Hi everyone, this is Shea Parker, the host of Best of the Best, which airs live right here on IOM Radio every Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern and 5 p.m. Pacific. I'm super excited to bring you expert guest hosts, spiritual discussions, free psychic readings, and so much more. I can promise that you will not want to miss this one-of-a-kind, fun, yet touching, down-to-earth show. Join us every Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Pacific on OTRFM. This is Shea Parker, and I can't wait to see you there.
Hi, this is Bill Maher. I can find humor in almost anything, but one thing I never laugh about is cruelty to animals. If you don't get the joke either, write People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, 501 Front Street, Norfolk, Virginia, 23510.
And we're back on Destination Unlimited. My guest this evening, Henry Frisco Weiss. He's the author of the new book, Caring for the Dying, The Doula Approach to a Meaningful Death. So in your book, Caring for the Dying, you outline how a layperson might become a doula for a dying friend or a loved one, emphasizing thoughtful planning for the last days, how it might look and sound and feel. Can you please explain to our listeners some of that planning and why it's so important to pre-plan?
It's important to pre-plan because we want the last days of life to unfold in a way that really fits and feels right to the person who's dying as well as family. And there's so much we can do to bring greater meaning into the experience for everyone as well as a greater comfort. So we want to take a look at things like, where is the person going to die. Many people would prefer to die at home, and I think that makes the most sense because it's the place where we're most comfortable. Everything is familiar to us. We have brought things into that space that have meaning for us. And so we want to be able to die among those things and with the people around us that we love. But we want to pay attention also to where in that house or in that facility, room or apartment, where is the person going to be dying? And when they're lying in bed, what do they see when they look straight out in front of them? Are they positioned in a way that they can look through the window if looking out into the sea, the sky and the leaves on a tree as they dance in the wind, and to be able to have that experience as they're lying in bed? Or are the photographs of family placed in a way that they can easily see it? Or objects that have great meaning to them, maybe art, maybe things they've collected. So we want to create an atmosphere and a feeling that's really special for the person who's dying. So we want to look at the space and see what's in it. We also want to think about what kind of sounds are in the space. Music is very important to all of us. It speaks to us in a very deep way that we can't address with just language. And so music can be very reassuring and comforting and can ease even some of the physical symptoms that people experience. People who have Alzheimer's disease benefit a tremendous amount from individualized playlists of music, and so we want to help to bring that into the space. What kind of scent? How do they feel about touch, and how do we bring touch to them or holding them in ways that help bring them greater comfort and make us feel like we're really engaged with them in a very intimate way? Are there readings, either spiritual readings, readings from the Bible, readings from poetry that would also help them to go deeply inside to a place where they connect to, you know, their sense of what a higher power might be or something beyond themselves? So all of this work in planning really helps us to make that time very special for the person who's dying as well as family. One of the other things that we pay attention to is how do people enter this space? We know that the mind state that we bring into any space affects that space. So we want to try and make that space feel sacred to the person who's dying and family. So many times we'll ask people to take off their shoes at the doorway before they enter the room, or to sit on a chair and raise up a feeling of gratitude for what they have shared with the person inside that room who's dying, so that they walk into that space and bring a different mindset, one that is allowing of the momentous nature of what's happening there. It makes a tremendous difference.
Absolutely, and I assume that the environment setting, when you bring guests in, is designed in such a way that whatever feelings of pain or anguish the visitors might have, they let go of that before they enter that space.
Yes, as much as possible. Not to say that tears, quiet tears aren't accepted and appropriate in those times and at that space at the bedside. But some people will be very clear that they don't want people breaking down and loudly sobbing at the bedside, that that's not going to help them as they're trying to let go of their body. Other people are more open to whatever happens, and they don't want people to feel like they have to hold back. So it really depends upon the person who's dying that we're working with, as well as family. And one of the principles of this work is that it's always about them, not about us. So as doulas, we try not to bring our own values and beliefs and impose them on this experience for the person who's dying or family, but rather to make sure that we're uncovering what is the best for them and helping them to have the experience that suits them and fits with what they envision their dying to be.
Now, if the discussion has not been held prior to this point, how appropriate is it appropriate to talk about last requirements in terms of funeral and what they'd like done at their funeral?
It's always appropriate when it becomes right for the people who have to make those plans. So if that hasn't been discussed prior to our involvement or prior to when the person is what we call actively dying, when the body is finally breaking down, we will certainly inquire of family if they have made plans, if they've thought through how they want to do a funeral or a viewing of the body or memorial service, and have they made the plans that they need to make. Sometimes people have a kind of a superstition about making plans in advance, so they don't do it until even after the person dies. So if that's the way this family needs to work, we will support that as well, and we will help them through the initial calls they might have to make to make arrangements. Generally, people have an idea, even if they haven't actually made arrangements.
And in terms of facilitating when the person has transitioned, facilitating the funeral process, do you recommend that they contact the funeral home and the physician so that all the arrangements are made so that when the person does transition, the death certificate will be prepared and the funeral directors can come and take them away?
Generally, we try to help people understand that they have as much time as they would like. So there's no particular rush to call the funeral home. If it would feel better to them to have their loved ones still in the home or in the space that they've been in for a while longer, knowing that this will be the last time they're in that space, to use that time to sit around and do rituals. One of the things that we do a lot of is we help people design rituals for right after the last breaths, or just to spend time telling stories, talking about the person, continuing to go over and touch them and caress their face or give them a kiss. We often do this by being as much as we can around the bed, perhaps having candles in the room, making it feel really special, and spending the time that they need. If the person is a hospice patient, then we would call the hospice relatively soon after the death just to have a nurse come and pronounce so that a death certificate can be created. But for the funeral home, we can wait, and I always tell people, don't call until you're really ready, because sometimes the funeral home people will come, even if you say, you know, come in 2 hours, they might come earlier because it fits with their schedule better. So call when you're ready to have the funeral home come, and they generally come fairly quickly. So, you know, take the time you need and don't rush the body leaving the space it's been in.
Absolutely. The reason I mentioned that is that when my Judy transitioned, in preparation for that, the doctor said to avoid having to have the coroners come and take her away and then have to go to the hospital to identify her and have her released to the funeral home, that if all of these prearrangements are made, we would have the availability of time to spend with her and process final wishes and thoughts and feelings prior to calling the funeral director and having them take her. So I think it's something to logistically, it may sound a little cold and unemotional, but logistically I think it's really important, because rather than have the coroners come, you'd rather have people who are caring and loving come to facilitate the last moments together.
Yeah. So, and it depends on where somebody dies, because if it's in a hospital, for example, it's different from when it's in their own home. So, you know, hospitals have some rules, although hospitals today are pretty indulgent to allow people to spend time having the person stay in the room as long as they need, and they don't usually push people. But if you've had a conversation with the doctor in advance and the floor nurses, so everybody's aware of what your wishes are, that certainly does help, I think.
How often do you encounter people availing themselves of home hospice these days?
It's just a beginning now. It's a new movement, and the word is spreading, but it's still not really as prominent as we would like to see it. So where there's programs that exist and hospices and hospitals are starting to to create doula programs or some kind of vigil program. In those settings, then it's much more accessible. But when you get outside of the areas in which these programs are starting to appear, then it becomes harder to find availability of doulas, or at least access to doulas. So it's the early stages of a movement, and it's been developing very rapidly, but still there's a very long way to go.
I was very grateful when my Judy was in her final days that Cabrini had a home hospice program and trained me in terms of the medical care and the palliative care, and allowed us to bring her home, and it was a beautiful experience. My guest this evening on Destination Unlimited, Henry Frisco Weiss. He's the author of Caring for the Dying, The Doula Approach to a Meaningful Death. Henry, please share with our listeners where they can get your book and find out more about this amazing work you do.
The book is available in bookstores everywhere. It's also available online through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, IndieBound. So virtually anywhere that you you go looking for books, hopefully you'll be able to find it. But if you don't find it in your local bookstore or library, you can certainly find it online through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or other online booksellers.
And what's your website?
Our website is the International End of Life Doula Association, and the address is INELDA, INELDA.org.
And we'll be back with Henry Frisco Weiss after these messages on the OM Times Radio Network. Are you in an interfaith relationship and thinking of getting married? For 18 years, Reverend Lori Sue Brockway has been creating personalized, loving, and romantic ceremonies for couples of all faiths and cultural backgrounds. Reverend Lori Sue's sensitivity to the needs of interfaith couples is reflected in the compassionate and inclusive way she addresses the concerns of parents and families. Reverend Lori Sue is also the author of several best-selling books on interfaith weddings and wedding vows. Selected as one of the top interfaith officiants by New York Magazine, Reverend Lori Sue serves couples in the New York metropolitan area and beyond. Find out more at her website, yourinterfaithwedding.com.
The average time a resume spends on an HR manager's desk is 7 seconds, and most of them are tossed aside. Now imagine if one of those resumes belonged to Yasmin, who was
living in a shelter, juggling 3 jobs. I had to be resilient. That's something that you can't teach.
We rely so much on a resume, yet it could never tell the full story of someone who
had to be independent and take initiative, and that's how I handle every project I get.
Discover new ways to develop great talent at gradsoflife.org. Brought to you by Grads of Life and the Ad Council.
Every Tuesday on Living with Moxie, join Shefali Burns and Donna Martouge in conversations designed to take you to the next level, where we highlight ideas, resources, and strategies that provide you with the leverage you require to meet and exceed your business and personal goals. Each week on Living with Moxie, we will lead conversations related to success, achievement, fulfillment, and extraordinary, vibrant living. Are you ready to live with Moxie? Join us.
You're listening to OTR-FM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
And we're back on Destination Unlimited. My guest this evening is Henry Frisco Weiss, the author of the book Caring for the Dying, The Doula Approach to a Meaningful Death. So we were talking a little bit, you mentioned before, about superstitions, and I'm wondering, how do religions and cultural differences you've encountered through the doula work shape your practice to fit their particular needs?
We always try, when we're working with somebody, to understand their cultural background, their religious heritage, the faith communities that they may belong to, so that we can make sure we're attending to their needs in those areas, because culture does impact how we make decisions about the care we get, what kinds of care we want, who makes the decisions in our family. All of those things are impacted by culture, can be impacted by culture. So as doulas, we always inquire, what is important from your cultural perspective at this point in your illness and as you approach the last days of your life? Are there particular things that we need to do to honor the way your culture handles death and dying, or to adhere to the principles that you want to follow in terms of your religion? So we've had people who want certain passages that are read because that's really important to them. We had a man from Turkey who was a Muslim who only wanted one passage of the Quran chanted continuously through his dying process. We had a Buddhist person that we worked with who insisted that his body not be touched for 3 days after he died, to honor the fact that his spirit would perhaps be near and need to be near his body before his body was moved, and that moving his body might interfere with that process of separating and moving into the next level of existence. So we need to understand those pieces and make sure that we're honoring people's backgrounds and wishes in a way that makes sense for them.
Have you ever encountered anyone whose either cultural or faith background would not allow doula representation?
No, I haven't had that experience. I have had cultural impact on where they want to die. So we have in Chinese families, people often insist on going to the hospital or to an inpatient facility to die rather than dying at home. Dying at home carries with it certain fears around the spirits, you know, being there in that space or hanging around in that space or opening the door to other spirits that might come and stay in that space. So often in Chinese or Asian families, people decide to die in a facility rather than die at home. So those kinds of decisions. In Orthodox Jewish faith, a person, when they die, is supposed to have their feet pointing towards the door. And for a Muslim person, they want their head pointed towards Mecca. So there are those pieces that we want to acknowledge and make sure that we're doing it in a way that fits with what they need.
Absolutely. Now, as in life, as in transition, the gift of giving someone listening, non-judgmental, active listening, without having to impart our thoughts or our beliefs, and just allowing them to share is so, so important. You refer to this as walking alongside someone who is moving through the dying process. Please explain.
The reason I use that term, walking alongside someone, because I think it helps people understand that they're not there to fix something or to solve something for the person who's dying and family. They're there really to bear witness to what they're experiencing, to help them understand what's coming, what signs and symptoms mean, the naturalness of some of the things that they're experiencing, and to really be present to what they need to speak about and talk about. It's quite an amazing thing for people to be really heard and listened to in a deep way without the person throwing in stories about their life or commenting in agreement or disagreement about what they're saying, but to really be present and not impose yourself. And the image of walking alongside, I think, helps people to understand what they need to do, to be close to somebody and not to do anything actively to try and make them feel differently or do something different, but to be there as a guide and a support.
If the person is amenable to being touched, is it appropriate to hold their hand when they're doing this process?
Absolutely. I think touch is very important. We're social animals, and touch has always been important from the very first that we come into this world. we know that a baby will actually die if it's not touched and if it's not held and caressed. So touch is very important. And I have seen many times where people are awkward or feel uncomfortable or not sure about, is touch okay? So we need to certainly know when touch is appropriate for a particular person and how they feel about touch and what parts of their body. Some people are very sensitive about having their feet touched or caressed or held by somebody that maybe they don't know very well. So we want to understand how people are oriented to touch, but then touch is very important. And we go further than just holding a person's hand or lightly caressing their arm or their face, their head. Light massage at certain points is very appropriate. But we go into teaching or modeling a person how to get in bed and actually hold their loved one. And it's a very beautiful, intimate way of experiencing the person's whole body, which I think can be very comforting to the person who's dying. It's something I learned from birth doulas, that if you get behind somebody and have them lie between your legs so their back is up against your front, that you have this incredible capacity to basically hug their whole body with your legs, your torso, your arms. And it's an incredibly comforting and a wonderful, reassuring way of being physical with someone.
It's beautiful.
So for loved ones, you know, for a wife or a husband to do that with their partner, it's just a beautiful way to hold somebody.
Now, you talk about the Legacy Project. How does it help a dying person explore the meaning of their life, arrive at a sense of completion, or bring closure to unfinished business?
Legacy work, I think, has become a main focus of some of the work we do before we get to the point where the person is in their last days of life. So it's in the weeks and months before they get to that point, when they still have some energy or cognitive ability to participate. And one of the things that has struck me from the very beginning of becoming a social worker is that when people are dying, there's a natural, organic process of looking back over your life, really exploring, what's my life been about? What have I learned? Have I done a good job? Where did I mess up? Or what are the pieces that are still hanging unfinished, and is there anything I can do about that? Unfortunately, I think most people have moments of that, and it comes maybe in the middle of the night when they wake up and it's dark and everybody else is asleep, or they're sitting on the couch and the TV is on, but they've totally lost interest and they're just sort of drifting, and they have thoughts about their life or particular memories that arise. But nobody makes an effort to really spend time in a concerted way to help them pull those moments together, to do a continuous review of a person's life so that they can start to extract its meaning and understand what their life has been about and the impact and what they're leaving behind. And that's when we start to extract that meaning, it helps people to come to a sense of completion. Erik Erikson, the developmental psychologist, understood that at the very end of life, we need to move through a challenge of either finding a sense of completion or feeling despair about our lives. And to navigate that final stage of our life successfully, we want to try and look at the places we messed up as well as the wonderful things we've done to come to a sense of completion. And the Legacy Project is a continuation of that work. The work around meaning is internal. It's for the person who's dying often. The legacy work becomes something that the dying person or family are creating together to have left behind, to express some of those pieces of meaning in a way that family can return to and reconnect with the person and basically hear their voice in the future, even when they are no longer with us.
Would that include having a tape recorder or some type of recorder present to interview them, or even a video camera to get their thoughts and words and memories?
Yeah, that's one of the really good ways of doing this. We do many different kinds of legacy projects, from books to boxes to scrolls to audio and video. So we try to find the format that suits the kind of messages the person would like to leave behind. And we've had some really creative projects that people have done that were quite beautiful. We had a woman who collected sea glass from her times in Cape Cod when she would go to the beach. Often many summers she spent on Cape Cod, and she would collect sea glass. And when she was contemplating her legacy project, she decided to have holes drilled in bits of the glass to string them together on a strand. And then at the bottom, she placed cards that had a message of something that was important to her, maybe a couple of lines of a poem or something she valued, something that she said often, many different kinds of expressions. And then she gave these strands to friends and family so that they could hang them in their homes, and when the light came through, it would reflect these bits of color onto the walls and the floor, and it would remind them of her. And then there would be the message at the bottom that would speak to them as well. So it was like a distributed kind of legacy project. So lots of different kinds of projects.
Beautiful. My guest is Henry Fersko Weiss. He's the author of Caring for the Dying, The Doula Approach to a Meaningful Death, and we'll be back with more on Destination Unlimited after these words from the Om Times Radio Network.
Have you ever wondered how to change your love paradigm? The secret key is finding a love partnership, not just a regular connection. How do you find these? Through conscious relationships. Ascending Hearts Dating is a dating site for people like you that believes in second chances and a different type of spiritual connection. Try Ascending Hearts for free today at ascendinghearts.com and change your love paradigm. Ascending Hearts, the premier dating community for the spiritually awake.
Hi, this is Sylvia Henderson, intuitive life coach and energy healer. Are you ready to elevate and rise way above your normal? Be sure to listen to my show, Intuitive Transformations, on Om Times Radio, Sunday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. Get the inspiration you need to transform your life.
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Aliyah, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
They say that car crashes happen in slow motion. The reality is that crashes happen fast. There's no time to think and no time to check if your child is in the right car seat. Car crashes are a leading killer of children 1 to 13. Are your kids in the right seat for their age and size? Don't think you know. Know you know. Get more info at safercar.gov/the right seat. A message from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
And we're back on Destination Unlimited. My guest this evening, Henry Fersko Weiss. He's the author of Caring for the Dying, The Doula Approach to a Meaningful Death. Henry, earlier we were talking about guided imagery. How do doulas use it during the dying process?
There are many ways to use guided imagery. It's a very powerful tool. And so we always talk about its use with a dying person and family, and we sometimes design a visualization for the dying person and a different visualization for family. We always try to incorporate things that make sense for this particular person. So one of the ones that we do fairly often is what we call a special place visualization. And it's very useful for people to get a general sense of well-being by depicting to them through the visualization, guiding them to a place that they would love, that's very beautiful in nature. So Sometimes it's the beach. For some people, it's the forest with a stream running through it. For other people, it could be at the top of a mountain. So we try to find a place that they not only would feel is beautiful and peaceful, but where they may also have a sense of being connected to something larger than themselves. So that's very reassuring for people to be guided to a place like that. And even though it's in the imagination, it still has a great deal of the impact that they would feel if they were actually in that place. So that's one way we use visualization quite often. It can also be used for symptom management in times where we're between doses of a medication, for example, when the medication is wearing off and the person may be experiencing that symptom a little bit more, they can use visualization to help ease those responses, those symptoms. We can use it for spiritual purposes. It's very helpful for people who may be struggling with some spiritual distress, you know, doubting or questioning their understanding or their beliefs, and using visualization to help deal with that distress, that spiritual distress. It can be used in grief for the family as they're anticipating the loss or anticipating their grief, and after the person dies to deal with the loss and their grief. Visualization can be very helpful.
You know, not through visualization, but I've personally witnessed situations where people in their last moments actually said they saw people who predeceased them coming to welcome them. In particular, my grandmother said she saw my uncle and my other uncle and other members of the family coming to welcome her in her last moments. Have you seen that happen also?
Oh, many times. It's something that's fairly common that people do see and speak to and gesture toward beings that have died before them. Sometimes it's mostly it's family members or dear friends, but sometimes it's even wisdom figures or sages or figures that they're not sure exactly who they are, but they feel reassured and comforted, and they know that those entities are there to lead them into the transition that they're going through. So we see this quite a bit, and it's always fascinated me that people see them very often in the corner of the room where the walls and the ceiling meet. Mm. And that's where they see that. And I don't have an explanation for that, why the energy collects there, but it seems to. And so we do see that a lot.
Mm. Now, we had talked about the importance of rituals before. What sorts of rituals have you helped the dying and their families create?
We do rituals to start what we call our vigil. And the vigil happens when the person is beginning this process of active dying, when the body is finally breaking down. And so it's very appropriate to do a ritual that marks that occasion. You know, ritual is a way that we move from one reality into another, that we acknowledge that transition, and it really helps us to go through that transition in a better way. It brings us better balance as we experience those transition points. So beginning a vigil with a ritual is quite helpful. And a ritual to begin might start with, for example, lighting a particular candle that we will have burning throughout the time the person is in their vigil as they're actively dying, to be extinguished as part of a ritual after they die. It might involve sort of openly reading the vigil plan, the plan for what they want, the wishes they expressed about how the last days will unfold. It might involve people standing around the bed, holding hands, and just speaking from the heart, saying the things that they want to say to this person so that they continue to speak of their love, of their deep appreciation for who this person has been, to ask forgiveness or offer forgiveness, to say thank you for the things that have been important that they've brought into their life. kind of a way of offering blessings to the person who's dying. We have incorporated into those rituals particular music, a piece of music that the person would really love to have mark that beginning of their vigil. Sometimes dying people write a letter to their family that gets read as the vigil begins to offer what they want to say to family who are now going to go through these last days of watching them dying. So there's many different ways we incorporate ritual. And after a person takes their last breaths is a very wonderful time to do ritual. And the kinds of rituals we do at the end may mirror what we did at the beginning, but now perhaps we do a washing or a ceremonial washing of parts of their body or their whole body as part of this ritual of finally saying goodbye to the body that has housed the life for this whole time, to honor the body that has housed the life and held it with us while they've been in this realm. And so often washing their hands, washing the face, just offering blessings. We've had bowls of water with petals of flowers that float in this water, and then we take a petal. Each person will go up and take a petal from the bowl of water and place it on a part of the body and say, I bless you for this. I bless your mind for always thinking about us, for your lips for always expressing the truth or your love, for your hands for the work that you did to help take care of us or the things you brought into the world through your gifts. These are beautiful ways of marking occasions throughout the vigil.
Absolutely. Now the person transitions. How does the doula help the family process that grief?
We process it immediately by being present, offering opportunities for family to speak of stories that are particularly meaningful to them, ones that were very moving or funny or formative in their lives. And then we come back to family somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 to 6 weeks after the person has died. And we encourage them to tell the story of the dying process in great detail, day by day, what happened, what they were experiencing, what they saw, what they heard, how they felt about it, the things that we did and how they felt about those different things that we did during the vigil. And so we really process the story in great detail. And that helps first because people need to tell the story over and over again as they move through their grief, but it also helps to uncover some of the pieces of this experience that might end up haunting them, that keep coming back and playing over and over again in their mind. Maybe the way their loved one's face looked when they died, or the wasted way their face looked as they were approaching death, or the very noisy, wet, rattly breath that we hear in their chest, or perhaps it's something that was said or not said. And we want to uncover those so that we can help bring some perspective and maybe reframe it in a way that'll help them. And the doulas also speak about their experience and what they saw, because as objective sort of neutral witnesses to this process, they have seen things that the family may not hold on to, beautiful moments that the family may have forgotten or not been as conscious of. And the doulas give those experiences back to them to bring some balance to all the suffering and pain they've experienced, brings back some of the beauty and some of the love that the doulas witnessed.
Henry, if someone listening to us this evening, based on this wonderful work that you're describing, this truly, truly loving work, is inspired to pursue this, how do they do that?
Well, they should come to our website, which again is INELDA.org. And they will find there trainings that we're running all across the country. We do a training once a month somewhere, so they can certainly take a look for our schedule and take a training that we provide. They can read. We have a newsletter that comes out every month, so they can start to read and understand more about this process. They can attend our webinars. If they become a member of the organization, they can get our webinars, which we do every other month. And they can also pick up the book, Caring for the Dying, The Doula Approach to a Meaningful Death, which not only describes this approach, this end-of-life doula approach, but is filled with many stories that will help elucidate what this is really all about, how it feels from the inside. And I think it will help people to understand what they can do in their own lives with their friends and families, but also how they may serve other people, either by joining a program at a hospice that has an end-of-life doula program, or considering forming a small group to directly serve dying people and families.
Henry Frisco-Weiss, thank you so much for joining us tonight and sharing this wonderful work and this really positive message that people can bring to their loved ones and friends who are in the process of transitioning. Thank you. We'd love to have you back again in a few months and talk more about this topic.
I'd really love that. Thank you for having me on.
And thank you for joining us on Destination Unlimited. I'm Victor the Voice Furman. Have a wonderful week.